Well, Harry, can we just to introduce Catherine Candy for our second open access talk today. For many years now, Catherine has led strategic publishing initiatives at the University of California. She directed the publishing group at the California Digital Library, where she launched the e-scholarship program to provide alternative publication services for the University of California community. Today, the e-scholarship repository is home to more than 20,000 scholarly works, reflecting the output of over 200 University of California departments. More than 2,000 University of California Press monographs have been digitally published using an open source text publishing infrastructure developed at the California Digital Library. And a digital critical edition of Mark Twain's works was launched in October to wide acclaim. I've looked at it myself and was amazed at some of the material that they have made available this way. Catherine has been a leader in the University of California's efforts to promote open access and to build a sustainable scholarly publishing system. And we're privileged to have her here today to answer the question, whose knowledge is it? Catherine Candy.
Thank you. Familiar faces. Good, some unfamiliar faces. did I put it back in the right place? Okay, great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Stuart and Harvard, for organizing this, and congratulations to Harvard for passing its FAS open access policy. I've been asked to talk about the UC open access policy, and especially to talk about what happened at UC, because I think maybe you all have heard that UC actually began discussions of an open access policy a year ago. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to tell you what happened, and then I will tell you some of the lessons that we have learned and are actually now building upon, because as we speak, another version of an open access policy is actually being edited, and we're going to try to continue the process and hope to pass one. But in the process, we've learned a great deal, and we're really kind of reframing our whole, our sort of look at and reasons for pursuing an open access policy. So I want to take you through that as well. So first, the facts. In between December 2005 and August 2006, the Academic Council, with the system-wide Senate leading body. Actually, the Academic Council's Senate Committee on Scholarly Communications convened and began producing white papers, five white papers to be exact, and a draft copyright policy. Has any of you seen the actual white papers? Okay, great. Between May and July 2006, the Senate Committee on Scholarly Communications developed a written proposal for UC faculty scholarly work copyright rights policy, what it was called at the time, and that was endorsed by the Academic Senate and then forwarded to the president. And the president, and on the basis of that, asked for a faculty and staff working group to be convened. And it was that body that actually drafted the formal policy itself, the draft policy. I should tell you, in case you don't know, the University of California is so massive. There are somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 lettering faculty. And depending on where we are in the budget cycle, somewhere between 16,000 and 18,000 faculty and researchers altogether. And trying to organize a process like this of discussion among all faculty bodies is really quite something. So this, just getting this process going was really something, and it actually, it was fed some by negotiations with Elsevier that took place more than 3 years ago now, but during which negotiation, the faculty sort of interest in and awareness of some of the problems, the economic problems in scholarly publishing, really came to the fore and got people interested. So, but then of course it took quite a while to go through this whole process, and some of the passions died down. And happily, they're fired up again thanks to Harvard and NIH. So anyway, so in January 2007, the provost then, based on this draft policy and an action by the Senate committee, requested the, I'm reading my notes here because I want to make sure I tell you exactly right, requested both Senate and administrative reviews of this draft policy.
I'm sorry. Women's suits aren't really, you know, they don't have all the right
pockets and spots. Am I working? Sorry, it was a get the earphones off really quickly. I'm sorry. Okay, so the provost requested these reviews, and this the draft policy was taken up for, as I said, very, very broad discussion. In fact, the system-wide Senate requested that all of the divisional Senates take it up. Every single Senate committee also discussed it, system-wide Senate committees. And the local divisional, there are 10 campuses in the University of California system, and every campus had its Senate and its Senate committees discuss this. So, and it got down to the department level. So it was very widespread discussion. And what I would like to do is read you three little snippets just to capture the sort of the flavor and the content of this of the policy. The policy really began with some language about seeking a balance between publishers' goals and authors' goals of sharing the material to further scholarship. Also mentions, it asserts and confirms the UC faculty author as the copyright holder. And it also supports authors' retention of rights in order to use and develop their works without restrictions. So that was sort of one chunk. Another was that the faculty, and this is the language, shall routinely grant to the Regents of the University of California a license to place in a non-commercial open access online repository the faculty members' scholarly work published in a scholarly journal or conference proceeding. So specific to journal and conference proceedings. And then the third snippet is that faculty may opt out of this policy for any specific reason. That was a sort of critical piece of it. So that process began, and it continued until in July 2007. The responses had all come in from the committees, and the responses got compiled. And I was telling some of you over lunch or earlier that, here, I've brought them with me, all the letters reporting the results of all these discussions. Virtually every single letter begins with the faculty at, whatever, UC San Diego, or the faculty in the committee on research policy, or committee in libraries, strongly supports the intent, the goals of this policy, but finds the following problems. And some of those, the list were, 17 with, four subpoints under each one. Lots and lots and lots of problems. And the problems listed grouped nicely, unfortunately, into three categories. One was concerned with the burden of opting out. And this was because there just was not enough information given, enough detail or tools for faculty even know what this meant. And it appeared to them to mean it was up to each individual faculty member to figure out how to negotiate with the publisher or figure out what the publisher would allow and possibly have to risk not publishing in a journal, et cetera. And that appeared to be a terrific burden. But also, the more the individuals thought about the steps that might be required, the more it irked them. Because this really seemed to be a threat to academic freedom. It really seemed to be a threat to their autonomy to decide where they wanted to publish and to do what they needed to do. on this issue, we have learned since that with the implementation of the NIH policy, that all of this could have been dealt with much more simply and elegantly, because we've now developed a policy, a way to deal with the NIH requirement, and have developed a simple mechanism for the faculties in relation to the university, and a letter which any faculty author could attach to a manuscript saying, This research was funded by NIH, and by law, I am required to deposit the results of this research. Sort of end of story. So we really think that some of the problem on this sort of first grouping of problems was just the problem of being on the bleeding edge, because there just wasn't any advanced experience to look at, and just didn't know what all the different questions would be and what sorts of concerns would come up. A second thing, grouping of problems, we think was just a straight up mistake. Again, our own naivete, but there was an unfortunate link to, in a sort of prescription about how academic reviews ought to take place, and the fact that academic reviews ought to actually consider the behavior of faculty and whether things had been deposited in open access repositories or if they were in open access journals, or basically find a way to reward good behaviors by using the tenure and promotion system. That was the worst mistake in the whole policy, and caused a lot of concern. And obviously, the concerns with any one of these categories sort of flows over into the other. But the third and the saddest problem, actually, was that a number of the faculty bodies cited unknown and imagined support structures and costs. And I say that this is the saddest because, in fact, we've had an open access repository in place at the university for 5 years, and it's already used by more than 200 departments, and it's very, very, very simple to use, et cetera. But 80% of our faculty don't even know about it. So that's a whole other discussion that we can have at some point. But I think it's a good warning to us that it's not sufficient to just have these things in place, obviously. So, it was disappointing, but it was very, very useful. And the fact that all of these criticisms were couched in, real encouraging letters, really a lot of letters of support, that the message that we got, in fact, the cover note coming from the chair of the academics said, "So, here are all the suggestions. Please get back to us, with an improved version." So this is where we are. University of California is poised now to do something. And we didn't for a while because a lot of the way that all of these comments actually got synthesized by the Academic Council was in a suggestion that maybe what we should just do is an opt-in policy. And why don't we just take all these comments and rework the policy and send it back? And we all thought about that, and we thought, well, that's kind of the status quo, And so we chose not to do anything. This got delivered officially to the Office of the President, but we're working very closely with the Senate Committee on Scholarly Communications. We chose not to react to that at all. I'm just so glad that the NIH thing and Harvard did what it did when it did, because we could just sort of, what are we going to do now? And there was some sort of struggle about whether we should go ahead with this opt-in thing. And now that's dead. Nobody wants to do the opt-in thing. And now, the phone is ringing. It's like, if Harvard can do it, we can do it. So we've learned some real lessons just from having such widespread discussion. We've learned that there's terrific interest in doing this, and that it's not so premature. It was premature for us, as a university trying to figure out what it would take and what needed to be addressed. But now the time really seemed ripe, and we have learned our lessons. But we also had to look much more closely at the whole thing, especially because of the just time and resources that were used having this kind of discussion. And I mean, it really touched every faculty member in the system. We really had to think about, are we going to do this again? I mean, you don't want to do this repeatedly, and really you kind of get one more chance. I mean, if we tried again and used up that much time and it failed, nobody's going to want to hear about it for a long time. So there was a really sort of thoughtful calculation about, now or never, and the feeling is now. And so the policy is being rewritten, and it's being modeled very much on what the Harvard, the FAS policy attempts to do, and that is to avoid all the pitfalls of all the sort of crazy implementation details and establish the fundamental principle. So that's a good thing. That's something we've learned from the Harvard experience. We've also just, in with all the head scratching, really been kind of thinking more deeply about why exactly UC should have an open access policy, why we are even engaging in this whole big struggle. And I think that has actually been the most useful thing. And that, I think, informs my talk more than anything. Because I see it really as a shift toward an evidence-based approach rather than one of sort of policy and sentiment. I mean, not to say that there wasn't a lot of evidence that an open access policy would be a good thing, but there were a lot of principles of wanting to get back to the gift culture of the academy, or wanting to do what was right in sharing all this information, or just people being so galled by the amount of content that's given away to be bought back and whatnot. So I think actually we're getting a little bit more of a coherent approach to what I will now describe, of the open access policy is one piece. And I wave this because I invite you, if you're at all interested, I invite you to come and leaf through this. This is all actually all on the web. Has anybody found this stuff on the web? This is every, at the University of California, it's public research university, so everything, sunshine laws, everything has to be open. Even little receipts about how much you ate in the airport on your trip and things like that. But some of it is actually much more interesting than that. So every single letter coming from divisional senates or senate bodies or whatever, help yourself. So stepping back then, and then trying to reframe this, the sort of the data and the experience that we're looking at is sort of manyfold. I think some of you, or maybe a lot of you, know that UC has actually been involved in efforts to change scholarly communication for a long time, and especially in the libraries. But the University of California actually launched the California Digital Library 10 years ago precisely because, for two reasons. One, the budget crisis in the libraries was so vexing that multiplied, at the scale of the University of California, there was a feeling that something just really had to be done, and that intersected the opportunity to exploit network digital technologies to do things in new ways. And it started with finding economies of scale and licensing journals once for the system rather than buying 10 copies. So the story sort of begins really with the libraries. And from the library experience, we really have gotten our sort of economic analysis, and that is that the system, the current system, is unsustainable. It's unsustainable, and it's getting worse. And you all know the problems. But the specific problem, and it, again, because the UC is so big, it's sometimes easier to see it, we can't buy the materials necessary to support research to the level that is expected at the University of California. So we're still spending our $80 million a year, but we're getting a shrinking percentage of it. So it's not just that, oh, there's all this great stuff that's not getting out. The faculty and researchers at the university are not getting all of the materials that they need, and they're becoming aware of that. And so that is actually starting to sink in, and that actually shapes a lot of what we're doing. But also, from the press, we've learned that the university presses can't afford to publish what they consider worthy scholarship. So good, and you've probably all heard this story too, worthy, very, very worthy monographs get turned down. And why? Because the presses can't afford to publish it. And why can't they afford to publish it? Because the libraries aren't buying their books anymore. And why aren't the libraries buying as many books? Because libraries are spending so much money on journals, and especially in the sciences. And this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's in fact true that all the university presses have been having a very hard time. And I think almost any one of them will tell you that, yes, it's true that very, very good, very good books that should be getting published aren't getting published because they can't make the money. And because all of them have to watch the bottom line. So following from that, then, more and more we hear tales of faculty in humanities who can't get tenure because they can't get that first monograph published. And, you know, whenever this comes up, especially like a place like Berkeley or Harvard, you find a lot of people saying, well, that problem doesn't really affect me, but I know somebody or whatever. And, you know, there's a little bit of sort of distancing from that problem. But I was really enjoying a discussion meanwhile, or recently, in the Senate Committee on Research Policy, where a humanist volunteered the information that he had actually taken out a second mortgage on his house to help pay for a monograph that was being published, that he needed like a $40,000 loan or something. And the scientists were just like, just couldn't believe it. And but it sort of brought home the point. So those are rich lessons, all of those. We learned something really valuable, I think, from 5 years of running an open access repository. So the eScholarship repository is not really just a repository, whatever that means. It's a publishing platform. And with the full complement of manuscript management tools, there are peer-reviewed journals fully created within the repository, peer-reviewed journals. There are monographs. There are lots of preprints and technical reports, and basically pre-publication materials. And there is maybe about 10% of the content in it is our postprints, sorry, previously published materials that are deposited in the repository. And but so there's an awful lot of original content. And we actually, I get asked to speak a fair amount because people call it so successful because there are 20,000 objects in it, and you know, one object can equal an 800-page monograph or a 2-page, you know, working paper. But also because the materials have been used so heavily, there have been more than 5 million downloads. And the download, we're really, really thoroughly keeping out the robot counts. And to download something, you actually have to go through the metadata page and say, yes, I want to see this. You've already can see all the abstract and whatnot. So this is these are true uses. You know, it's not any finer than that. And you know, that would suggest that this is actually becoming a sort of serious part of the infrastructure, but for publishing and dissemination. But in fact, it has had virtually no effect that we can tell on the economic model or the economics of scholarly publishing. The more we analyze it, the more we look at it, we realize that a lot of what it's reflecting is, one, a trend toward new forms of publication, just the culture changing, whether it's in, you know, economics and just more and more working papers or whatever, or acceptance of open access journals, but especially the multidisciplinarity of scholarship and research. And we think actually what we're doing is we're picking up just some of the slack or some of the extra that isn't being addressed by the commercialized academic publishing system. And that's a very good thing for a university to provide. But when we started it, we were sort of modeling ourselves on the archive and physics, and we thought this is going to really change things, and we would just have to wait for all the journals to, you know, quit Elsevier and come marching over it. We didn't think it would be quite that easy, but we really thought it would have some effect. This, you know, just by the practice of putting things up, learning that a good peer-reviewed journal could be published and, you know, indexed in Medline and whatnot, would be enough to begin to change things, and it hasn't. So that was an important lesson. Then we did a study, the Office of Scholarly Communication, which is part of the grouping of services that I'm responsible for at UC. The Office of Scholarly Communication did a study of faculty attitudes and behaviors. The survey, which took us quite a while to develop, the survey went to nearly 5,000, about 4,800 faculty, and we got a 25% response rate. We were really surprised and thrilled. So we did a full statistical analysis. I mean, we got some significant results. And some of the things that we learned from that one thing in particular was very, very valuable. First we learned that an awful lot of people, a lot of faculty, did think the system wasn't working well. With few exceptions, people saw plenty of room for improvement, you know, with a whole range of proposals for how it might be improved. But the strongest and most important piece that came out was that faculty kind of across the board said, you know, you're never going to change the system based on my individual behavior. They didn't say it quite like this, but they said basically, no. You know, no, I am not going to take risks. If there's any choice between publishing in Science or publishing in this open access journal, Homegrown or whatever, of course I'm going to publish in Science. And they told us in many different ways that that things were not going to change based on expectations of individual faculty taking risks. And we were beginning to get the message that there really was no incentive for faculty to do this. We had hit basically about a 10% early adopter pool, and that had pretty much bumped up against the limit of that, and now we were being told explicitly that, you know, and so we had started to recognize that there was an incentive problem, but we were being told explicitly, look, I'm not going to do this, and I'm not going to tell my junior faculty to publish in these things, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So in some of the comments, the suggestion was, look, the university should be doing something. Why expect individual faculty to do something? University needs to do something. You go negotiate with the publishers, or you go do something. And we started to take that seriously. And so then following that, our system-wide, this is a provostial committee, system-wide library and scholarly communications, something, very, very long acronym body, asked that Lynn Withy, who's the director of UC Press, and myself at the time, the director at the California Digital Library, asked that we do a study of publishing needs across the system. And we spent about a year going from campus to campus and meeting with deans, vice chancellors for research, actually any vice chancellors we could meet with, and faculty, and really trying to get a closer handle on what people were doing, what publishing needs were emerging, what was behind some of this sentiment that we were hearing about, you know, not wanting to take the risks. But more importantly, what people were really interested in doing. And this is a process that we had done 6 years earlier before launching the scholarship repository, went out to faculty and just really tried to find out, okay, so what do you need the system to do for you? So this turned out to be very, very, very useful, especially because it gave us some sort of direct context to work with. But the thing that came out of that, those interviews, and we interviewed about 100 people. The results, by the way, of these two studies I'm mentioning are published on the web, and I can circulate the links if anybody is interested. But the really interesting thing that came out in the interviews was that the differences between the disciplines, the differences between the sciences and the humanities, for instance, was very, very, very stark. And we had seen this in the actual survey. It came out very strongly that the arts and humanities seemed to be the most interested and open to change, where we had had this sort of stereotype before of all these really cool things happening in the sciences. But then in our visits, what we learned is that the arts and humanities were absolutely desperate. And that, in fact, there had been a very interesting sort of trend toward adoption of digital technologies to do really cool things. And they were just not recognized. There was no way for the system to actually acknowledge and reward these publications. And you know, there were various theories. Some of it was that the departments didn't know what to make of it. There were a lot of different reasons. But a lot of what we heard was descriptions of very, very rich data being gathered, and all kinds of interesting databases are being built, and patterns being found by mapping data and, you know, looking at them over time. Humanists were especially interested with mapping GIS data over time, et cetera, et cetera. And then having to take all these rich findings and put them in a little box, which is a metaphor that one of the humanists used, in the form of a narrative, you know, a 200-page manuscript that said, you know, this is what I found. And they're just absolutely frustrated. And we found so much frustration. And it just came down to nobody knew quite what to make of these things. And sometimes the problem was that people were working in a multidisciplinary way, and between art and engineering, they, you know, were doing the more interesting things on the engineering side, and when they went back, when it was time for the chair of the art department or whoever to review them, you know, they didn't know what to make of it. But sometimes it was just that people were doing very, very innovative things, and they just hadn't been seen before. And and so what we came up with was, and this was really in consultation with faculty, was that the university, and in this case, in the form of the University Press and the California Digital Library working together, really needed to address the problem of there being no clear way to actually review non-traditional publications. And that actually a really valuable contribution of the university would be to step into this void in humanities where there hasn't been an infusion of cash. There aren't big, big, big expensive journals. There aren't commercial outfits that are drawing faculty into this process and sort of forging and codifying procedures for reviewing things. And that was actually an opportunity for the university, because in the sciences, that certification process has been managed and really sort of monopolized by the commercial world. So here's this opportunity and this crying need, and that the university needed to step into that. And so one of the, and this was actually the most important finding coming out of this this particular study. And so one of the recommendations in our report, and really the critical one, was that the university press and the California Digital Library would become the core of a collaborative publishing sort of venture, if you will, that we're really calling university as publisher, though we're starting to use that term much more broadly, but signifying that the university press was essential to the university being able to provide the kind of publishing infrastructure and services that are necessary for validation of communications and humanities, and that if the press could organize this process, drawing on faculty expertise, and help develop this sort of process, then clearly an imprint could be put on these kinds of things. But the problem is, of course, that the press doesn't have very much money, and the digital library can do a lot of the sort of technical work, but doesn't have the expertise, actually, to review these things or even to organize the review process. And so that led to discussions of the fact that the press actually is being asked to provide a service, and that the university really needs to support the press and to recognize that that is one of its mechanisms for this more general process of supporting the generation of new knowledge and providing for processes that actually help to certify that knowledge, as well as the infrastructure for managing and communicating that knowledge. So this then is the beginning of us, this is actually what led to my position. This was the beginning of us at UC starting to say, okay, yeah, this university publishing thing sounds right, but what does it actually mean? And actually doing practical things. So a little sidebar. So my position now is I am responsible for this sort of array of services. And I'm not sure that these are the services that would be arrayed if you just started tabula rasa and said, okay, you know, what would it mean to, you know, be a, you know, for the university to be publisher. But this is sort of what I've inherited, and there are a lot of some very good services there. So included are the University of California Press, the California Digital Library, the UC College Prep, which develops online courses primarily for high school use, AP courses and things like that, the UC TV station, the Office of Scholarly Communication, which is concerned primarily with policy and education, the language UC Language Learning Consortium, which is one of our first system-wide operations concerned with creating university courses, online courses, that can be taken by students in any campus. And there's something else that I'm forgetting. And what they have in common is that each of them is a kind of publisher. Each of them is concerned with providing infrastructure for, as I mentioned, for new content to be created and to be managed and communicated in some way. And so this is using the word publishing in the sort of original Oxford English Dictionary use of it, where it's really sort of to publicate. And this is especially a concern for the University of California as a land-grant institution. And what we're trying to break down is this sort of artificial, not so much an artificial distinction, but actually we've just kind of neglected some of our responsibilities outside scholar-to-scholar communication. So you see, you know, is the sort of the research piece of the sort of three-part public university system in California, and has emphasized research to the expense of teaching, but then especially to the expense of the public good that the university is supposed to address. And because of so much communication being in digital form, there's a perfect opportunity now to actually support scholar-to-scholar communication in a way that also supports teaching and also supports communication with the public. And so the attempt now is to look at all of these different sort of publishing entities and try to look much more holistically at what exactly, what role should the university be playing, and what exactly does it mean to have the expertise amassed in the university that we have amassed here, and to take all these different existing services, and then try to actually play much more of a sort of positive and controlling role in how things are actually certified, and therefore how they are actually used. So so this is, I think, the sort of cornerstone of what I'm calling our sort of retake on an open access policy, or what an open access policy has to do with anything and why we would even be pursuing this. I have absolutely no idea how long I've been talking. We got started late. You know, it's kind of the years again. Still working? Okay. Sorry, I have to do some editing when I'm done. Okay, so really, to restate the problem, then we're looking at the current situation and saying, okay, the current situation is no longer sustainable. It's unsustainable and it's completely wasteful. And we're creating content either to give it away and buy it back, or to sort of just toss it to the wind, because that's what's happening with an awful lot of content. And in fact, we have the services in place that would allow us to capture an awful lot of this. And so I'm going to tell you about some of the sort of projects and services that I'm actually trying to develop to address that. But more importantly, it's the recognition that without a really focused investment in the infrastructure for research and teaching, that we actually can't, that we're eroding our own capabilities to be a major research university. That it, ultimately, if we don't recognize the importance and centrality of an infrastructure for publishing and communication, as central as laboratories and classrooms and whatnot, that we are we're really undermining our own mission. And ultimately, that will play out in not being able to recruit and retain the faculty that we need, or attract the students that we want, or whatever. So once you start to focus the problem on, okay, we're actually losing ground, we're not investing in infrastructure, we're not going to be able to meet our main mission, then talking about an open access policy has a whole different context and a whole different sort of urgency to it. So I want to tell you about, I think there really are sort of five pieces to the UC strategy now. And I want to tell you a little bit about each of them, just so that you can sort of you can get a picture of what I mean by this more holistic approach or strategy. So, of course, the first is attempting to implement an open access policy where UC faculty would, by default, convey to the university a non-exclusive license, essentially, to manage and circulate the published articles and conference proceedings. And that is, we still think that is probably the most essential short-term step for securing the advancement and the application of knowledge, especially in sciences, that really is a critical step. The second aspect is to continue, and there's been some talk of this afternoon, to continue negotiating with publishers, but more aggressively, actually trying as a sort of behemoth force in the market, trying to negotiate much better terms and negotiate for rights on behalf of all faculty authors when we're actually negotiating the actual license for use of the materials that we're buying back from them. And we're having some success, and in some cases we've been even given a sort of break for and credit for being such major contributors of so much content. But you know, the prices is so, you know, we don't know if they're just jacking the price up $2 million and then they say, okay, well, we'll give you a $2 million break because you give us so many. But the terms are changing. There's more struggle, and it's a good area to be, I think, to keep pushing on. The third is this formal collaboration that I mentioned between UC Press and CDL. Some other pieces of that I didn't mention is what we're trying to do is combine all of the journal services of both UC Press and CDL and provide a whole sort of menu of options for faculty wanting to publish journals. We don't think we're not going head-to-head with Elsevier, and we don't think that a university press or a digital library can even compete really against the really big commercial publishers. But new journals do continue to be launched. And usually what happens is the university is putting a lot of money up. There's a new research area and the work sort of bubbles up and a new journal gets formed. And when it gets some legs, and then it goes off to Blackwell or somebody. And that if we could be working with people at the beginning, and if the university is investing, and this is where it's most important to, and this is part of the strategy, is to align the publishing efforts with emerging research areas, with the actual research priorities. And at the University of California, that's not surprisingly, it's energy and environment, education, global health, and what we're calling public humanities. So the idea is get focused on where the money is going, and try to bring the support in before the publications bubble up and then be there to provide those services. Part of the strategy, too, is to try to figure out how to work more productively with societies. And some people have talked and written about societies being the brain trust that can provide the actual peer review process that we resent handing to the commercial world so much. But I think the most critical piece of the sort of university as publisher piece is the actual certification of non-traditional publications. And I think that's actually the greatest contribution that the university world can do now to, in a very positive way, to the sort of publishing crisis, and especially to arts and humanities, because I think that's an area that's been so underserved, and nobody else is going to do it. There's no money in it. So we're the only ones that are going to do that, so we need to. Another area, though, that we're beginning to consider as a kind of publishing is creation of online textbooks and online courses. And here we have one developed body, our college prep program, that knows how to make courses, knows how to sort of design and spec and all of that. It requires working closely with a content expert and a faculty, and also some pretty sophisticated technical partners. And so we're looking at sort of backbone capacity. And really what's starting to happen is all through the system is different sort of groups and labs and whatnot are starting to make online courses. And we think that this is going to really take off in the next 5 years, and that what the service that needs to be available is the know-how and the technical capability that can be brought to any faculty member who wants to create their courses online and just needs the help to do that, but also credit. It sort of goes back just like with publishing in open access journals. There has to be some sort of reward for that, for creating courses. And the sort of logic behind this is, okay, well, if we have, especially at a research university, people sort of resenting and frustrated that they're teaching courses, their teaching load is too heavy, and they could be doing all this creative work if they weren't teaching so much. Why not help develop the tools, at least the course materials, if not the entire online course, so that that could be made more efficient and some of the best teaching could be shared more broadly. But especially around textbooks, because here again is another economic dysfunction. It's not so true in some of the larger campuses of the University of California, but in the new campus, like UC Merced, there's a problem that is commonly felt in the community colleges and the state colleges, and that is that the textbooks are so expensive that students actually avoid taking classes where the textbook is so expensive. And so there's a critical question of access to education. And so we're starting to team together with the community colleges and the state colleges, and we're starting to think, well, wait a minute. If we're creating an AP statistics course for the high school, if 80% of the students in California are arriving for the community colleges unprepared for college, we should be using those courses in the community college as well. And then the state university, of course, is interested in getting involved. And all of a sudden, we have some very exciting projects going across the different segments. And so we are now going together with the community colleges to the governor and trying to get money for that to say, okay, look, our faculties can actually review. They can select and do the peer review for this content. This is a very important contribution to the knowledge and the capability to teach. And it needs rewards. And there's no reason not to consider building infrastructure for this kind of an operation the way we're talking about infrastructure for scholarly publishing. So that's on the sort of education piece of it. And then there are some miscellaneous services that, well, miscellaneous, I'll give you an example. We're starting something called Conference in a Box, UC Conference in a Box, because we were actually doing this when I was at Stanford. And so, but it's okay with my Stanford colleagues, we did the UC version. And basically what that means is trying to provide a unified set of services to an activity that is so ubiquitous at UC with so many, you can imagine how many conferences there are. And so here, what we're imagining, and we're working with some guinea pigs. So we have, right now, there's a quadrennial meeting of plant nutritionists that's going to be at UC Davis in about a year. And it's a very important meeting, and it's generally attended by researchers from more than 240 countries, and at least 60 of them rely specifically on the content that comes out of the conferences, but especially the journal articles and everything that come out of them, for their agriculture policy. And so it's a really, really, really critical conference. But like so many conferences, it just gets run out of this poor plant pathology department in Davis, and individual faculty are, you know, going into hoc trying to get things going, and a giant proceedings comes out of it. Literally, the book is this big, and it takes about 2 years to get, because all these researchers that get sent by their governments, they have to have their thing published in this giant, huge, it's just, it's the biggest one. I couldn't believe they even brought it. They brought it to our office so we could have this meeting, and it was all dusty, and so, you know, so we look at this and we think, okay, well, one, there we have all the capabilities for setting up the website, allowing registration. We have the repository. We could manage all of the paper submissions. We've got an entire peer review process. We could digitally publish with the press. We could digitally publish the conference proceedings. We also have a whole TV backbone. And every major person in this field is going to be at this thing. And we have people that know how to do interviews, and even people at the press are interested in interviewing. And so this discussion started up about the kinds of, the way we could use social networking technologies to just improve the conference itself, but also just to capitalize on the specialists in this field being in town, interview them. And as soon as the UCCP people, the college prep people, heard about that, they said, those are learning objects. We want to grab those. So, you know, it's just a project, but it's become a real sort of learning experience about just looking at across the entire system and seeing all the different services that are there and thinking about these are communication opportunities and thinking about new ways that things could be done. And there's at the center of it, there's an issue of in plant nutrition, plant pathology especially, there's a trend toward holding the paper back so that you can publish it in the peer-reviewed journal and get more credit and all that, and trying to actually bring around this conference the key people, since they're actually reviewing these articles themselves anyway, and trying to publish out of that the key work, which is, you know, some of what we've been talking about, the possibility of bringing that certification back into the academy. So that service that started out as just a kind of practical, let's use all these different services and unify services support for conferences, turned into the richest discussion about the, you know, new knowledge being created and shared in so many different ways. So sorry to go if I went on too long, but I wanted to put the sort of importance and the reason for going after an open access policy at the University of California in that broader context, because I actually think it adds actually urgency to it, but it also reminds us that the open access policy by itself is not going to change everything, but it's going to help an awful lot to begin to just take control of the copyrights. And this is why, to me, it's so extremely critical that the issue of the management of faculty copyrights is at the center of all this, and that it's not actually sufficient to just set up a repository and open stuff up so that more people can see it. It's the most substantial part of it is the beginning of the change to actually permitting and, in fact, demanding that the university manage those. The individuals can hold their copyrights, but the university can actually manage those rights on behalf of the university community and the world. And it's actually the only way that we can get back to the proper role for the university. And back to my first example of, you know, sort of the Greek temple, which is what our universities are about and what's supposed to be happening here. This is about creation of knowledge and sharing of knowledge. So that's it. I'll stop there and I'll take questions. Yes.
I wonder if you could go back and talk a little bit about the relationship with the press. So was the press brought into your office? And how was that relationship in the beginning and now? I'm just curious, because the press is fairly traditional.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
did they deal with that?
That's a good question. The relationship with the press actually started 8 years ago. Lynn Withey and I started working together. She was, I think, associate director and head of sort of strategic planning or something, and I was running the e-scholarship program at CDL. And we just started meeting weekly. I asked if she wanted to have coffee, and we started scheming, and we did a bunch of discrete projects together. So we had already had a meeting of the minds a long time ago, where we said, look, it's crazy for you to be trying to retool yourself for digital publishing. You have expertise that we don't have. Let's, you know, avoid duplication and work together. And so we did that for many years on very discrete projects. The Mark Twain archive is the most recent. Coming into this broader discussion, this wasn't so much about the press coming into my office. Well, my office is kind of like the 10th and a half floor. I mean, it's so, John Malkovich, it's so new that we're not sure what it is. In fact, that's why I hesitated to use the word university as publisher, because sometimes university as publisher means, okay, that which we will peer review and or vet other bodies to peer review, and formally publish something that, you know, heretofore has been unpublished. And sometimes it means that which the university certifies as something that's valuable, a course, where we want to have a platinum version of a course, and for assessment purposes and all kinds of things it's important. There's all kinds of agricultural materials that go into the community. I mean, there's so many different types of activities. So we haven't actually sorted that out. And so it's a little bit vague. And so in the meantime, trying to sort out the business relationship and the different business models it's just been tricky. We've been talking about it forever, and we're working with a business planner. And what we've done is kind of separate part of UC Press, because it's a giant, you know, organization, 150 people and whatnot. In truth, it's kind of doing things the way it's been done since about 1935. You know, so it's really a very, very old model. And we just kind of put boundaries around a certain amount of it and said, okay, So the whole sort of journals division and a certain amount of these experimental publications and whatnot are going to be part of this area where we will evaluate success based on criteria other than financial success. And so we've gotten some money up front for just this sort of experimental piece of it. And the explicit terms are this is a service to the university, and you have to sort of sort out what, you know, it's limited funds, so, you know, we can't do everything. But that it doesn't, it's really still sort of experimental, and it doesn't solve that greater problem of should the university press be on the dole the way the library is, and how do you manage the very, very difficult problem of having kind of tiers of imprints and reviews. And it's extremely important not to dilute the power, the quality of the UC Press imprint. But at the same time, and by their own admission, a lot of very good things are not getting published that should be, and there is probably a much greater capacity to review things if we change the way that's done by these external, we're calling it distributed editorial bodies. So that the whole editorial committee of UC Press is, you know, chewing this over. Everybody's sort of chewing this over. So it's not, there's not a very satisfying answer for you, but I would say we're right in the thick of it. There's real intention. We know we can do it differently, and we know that the press can get back closer to what it was created to do 100 years ago, where it really was just straight-up service to the university. But stay tuned for more.
Yeah. So you've got only one more shot on the open access policy. Can you describe what you expect the timetable and the process to be?
Sure. maybe I shouldn't have said that on tape. One more shot. Or maybe I should. Because things move kind of slowly, we don't think that the whole process can unfold before the summer. Oh, that was our first hope. And what's happening now is the policy, the new policy, is being edited, reworked, and it will be submitted to the Academic Council with the idea of that the Academic Council can vote on it and before the summer request expedited consideration on the part of the divisional senates on all the different campuses. And the idea with that, and that would take place at the beginning of the fall. And the idea with that is that will coincide with town hall meetings that are being planned, that were being planned anyway, because Slezak, coming from a whole different angle based on Lynn's and my report, was really determined to get this discussion going about the peer review process and the caps, the academic promotion committees and all of that. And so, I don't know, it could be a total train wreck, or it could be this wonderful sort of dovetailing of interest. But the system is starting to gear up toward fall meeting, town hall meetings in the fall. So if all goes well, and if this actually gets played right, it is possible, because we've seen it happen in a six-month window at UC. It could end with coming into Thanksgiving. It would have to be concluded by Thanksgiving with this a policy being adopted. And that's our greatest hope. So that's the timeline we're working on now. Yeah?
I want to follow up what you said about negotiating with Elsevier for a price discount based on the contributions made by University of California. Because the University of California is so large, it has maybe more bargaining power than any other university. And I wonder if you might try the Ohio Lake strategy of trying to get archiving rights for California faculty at the same time in these negotiations.
That's a good question. I have to confess I'm so far from the negotiating part of the world now, because I'm not actually in the California Digital Library, but sort of coordinating above it. I will certainly bring that back. Ivy Anderson, our director of collections system-wide, has told me that there is a lot of negotiation going on with a lot of publishers. She didn't specifically mention Elsevier, by the way. But the Elsevier negotiations will be coming up again next year, because when we had our big knockdown dragout, a few years ago, that was the deal we got was for 5 years. So that will be coming up in 2009, I believe. Well, it's a good point. I will pass that on. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.